Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, Jimmy.
Hey, SaifEddin. How's everything?
Everything is good. Welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, obviously. We've seen each other quite a bit, and yeah, it's good to see you again, because, you're halfway across the world and everything else.
Yeah, but we've still managed to get a lot of the time together, both our families, over the last year. And I still did manage to get to read your book before you published it, and I wrote a blurb about it. So I'm quite happy about that. Congratulations on the publication of the book.
Well, thank you. And I got to say, I'm trying to keep up with your work, too. And I'm still in the middle of, Principles of Economics, right? I got to say, I'm going through each chapter slowly because there's just so much to learn in each chapter that I can't go quickly. It's just, there's so much there. So anyway, thank you for your work. And I see it as a great honor that you like the work that I do, because you're obviously really good at what you're doing.
All right. I think we should maybe stop the mutual compliments and get straight into it. So your book is Fiat Ruins Everything. Pretty bold claim. But it's not one that I'm going to dispute. I think there's pretty compelling evidence that it is. You know, in the Bitcoin space, and I would say probably even more in the Bitcoin adjacent space, there's a very persistent idea that, you know, obviously these Bitcoiners are just taking things way too far with their orange coin. And even if people would grudgingly admit that, okay, orange coin good, You know, there's something nice there going on. But you can't just tell us that everything is ruined by fiat. You know, fiat can be bad. Perhaps there are problems. Perhaps you have a point. Perhaps this is a little bit of an upgrade. But you take it too far when you talk about food, or you talk about art, or you talk about fashion, or you talk about all of these seemingly unrelated things. You know, clearly money has nothing to do with those things. How would breaking the money influence those things? And I think it's absolutely amazing that you are just doubling down on this and writing the book saying, well, you know, you want to find out why? Well, here it is. This is how it ruins everything. And, you know, frankly, it's a little bit like fishing in a barrel, as they say. It's it's a pretty easy thing to do. I was thinking about it just today. The job of economics, if you read an average economist's paper today, it's got all kinds of very rigorous analysis of empirical evidence on some kind of tiny little thing. Some tiny little change happens in the world, and then what happens 15 years later to some other thing? And then try to discern the impact, and then try to figure it out over all kinds of little mundane things. And yet, the fact that we've gone from a form of money that used to appreciate to a form of money that is built to depreciate is something that they just happen to not like to talk about in terms of its impacts, you know? So all kinds of little tiny minute policy changes that most people don't understand or hear about. These things, you know, we spend hundreds of man hours a year, thousands of man hours, or maybe tens of thousands of man hours a year trying to figure these things out. Whereas breaking the money is just something that we don't talk about. And of course, the Abbotsford is people don't like to ask that question because their funding comes from breaking the money. So that just leaves a lot of fish in barrels for like you and me to go and fish because there's all these very obvious problems in the world because of the money being broken. But all the people that are supposed to be looking at the economic issues of the world and studying them, they're getting paid to turn their eyes away from all of these low-hanging fruits of what is the impact of inflation on society. And that's why I'm very happy that you decided to make a book out of it, because you know I've made a couple of books out of it too, but not at least not so directly. But no, you did. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, thanks. And it's interesting that you point out your field of expertise, economics, about how they just ignore this very, very obvious thing that's affected everything. But it's not just economics, right? It's all kinds of things where you have this fiat mentality of ignoring the very obvious thing. I know you like to go on about correlation and causation with regard to vaccines and climate change and things like that. But there are very obvious things that can explain a lot of stuff, and people just ignore the very obvious fact that a lot of people got vaccinated and they are suffering. But you know, the academics, they do not want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. And similarly with something like climate change, they do the same thing where it's like, well, you know, Earth has had a lot of temperature variability. Why are we like looking at this tiny, you know, insignificant temperature changing thing with carbon dioxide and not any of this other stuff that affects climate way more? And it's kind of an interesting sort of blindness that a lot of academics have as a result of the incentives that they have.
Absolutely. I agree entirely. I think it's also quite interesting that you don't see any kind of coherent response from the fiat world to these kind of critiques. Like, my book, The Fiat Standard, has been out for a couple of years now, and in it, I make the argument that all of nutrition science and all of climate science are basically inflation cope. It's just people getting funded to try and come up with excuses for why you shouldn't eat meat and you should consume fuels, because those are the things in which inflation shows up, because these are the things that you consume regularly and repeatedly. You know, you need to consume food every day, and you need to use fuel every day. And so that's where inflation is felt the most. It's not like a couch, which you buy once every 5 years or every 10 years. It's with food and with energy. And it's no coincidence that since the money got broken, the sciences that study those things have come up with the conclusion that you need cheap stuff. You need to focus on cheap stuff. That's the stuff that's good for you. And yet, I've not seen any person trying to offer any kind of coherent rebuttal for that. And I don't think we're going to be seeing much, because basically, nobody's paid to study those things. People are paid to ignore them. They're paid to just point your attention toward other inconsequential garbage issues. Mental candy, which is what most academics today produce.
Yeah, it's we're rationalizing creatures and not rational creatures in under a fiat standard, where people want to justify stuff like eating cheaper, being poorer, essentially. And this is something that I've gotten from you quite a bit, is that, you know, we're coping with the fact that we're getting poorer everywhere, right? Like, we can't afford houses or good food or good, you know, transportation. And they're giving us rationalizations on why, or some moral justification or something like that. And this is part of this control mechanism that you pretty much have to do to fund all of these rent seekers that are essentially living off of the inflation and money printing that is going on daily.
Indeed. Indeed. Absolutely. So tell us about your book. What does fiat ruin? Let's start from the beginning.
So first of all, what was the inspiration for writing this book? You know, we're always on Twitter and on our podcast, we're always saying all of those things in which they're broke, in which fiat is broken. What inspired you to write a book about it?
Well, part of it was we have been talking about it for quite a while. And I had taken this online class for, you know, learning how to write. My friend David Perel runs that thing. And during that, I wrote a whole bunch of stuff with regard to fiat money. And I realized that there was a pattern. And I felt like I could write a lot more. And I felt more empowered to just sort of keep writing it. It started as a bunch of articles for Bitcoin Magazine. And then, you know, I collated them. I guess reading your fiat standard was a major part of it, because reading that just sort of, you know, you explain the mechanics of fiat money and like tracing exactly how fiat money ruins a lot of different things. I felt like was an important part of being an advocate for Bitcoin, because in a sense, we're very used to, you know, saying something like Bitcoin fixes this. We know that Bitcoin changes a lot of incentives, but in a way that's the real thing that's happening is that the incentives of fiat money are so bad that it's kind of like stopping, you know, eating arsenic or something like that. It's the removal of the bad thing more so than the addition of the good thing that helps. So I wanted to lay that out in a good way, an entertaining way, hopefully, to, you know, help people that are already in Bitcoin to really have the tools to argue that, yeah, fiat money is really bad and things are going to get so much better if we can remove it.
Yeah. So what is the structure of the flow of the book? Walk us through it.
So the first part of the book is just making the argument that fiat money is pretty evil in of itself. Just morally speaking, it is just an evil institution. The government, the money printing, the central banks, they are able to essentially steal from everybody without really any compensation or even knowledge. And then I go into the incentives at different levels. So at the individual level, you know, how do things change? What are the things that we normally would do under a sound money standard that we don't do under a fiat money standard, and vice versa? And then I go up a level from the individual level, the company level. Unfortunately, that seems to be how we're organized, rather than by tribes or families or what have you, that used to be the norm. And how companies are very unsatisfying for a lot of people for a myriad of reasons, not, all of which basically go back to the ubiquity of fiat money. And then I go up another level and talk about the nation state incentives and how that changes how we're governed, how things are done on a national scale, the intrusion of government over the past 130 years is largely due to the presence of central banks and fiat money. And then finally, I talk about, then the level above that is the global level and the current dollar hegemony that exists and how that changes so many incentives, you know, for a lot of people, a lot of nations, and how they conduct themselves. And obviously, you and I have talked about a lot of that privately with regard to how foreign policy is very intricately linked to the monetary system and how you can influence another country just by, you know, giving them different outs when they're in trouble and so on. And finally, I talk about altcoins and fiat money and how we're beset on both sides, you know, by both no coiners and altcoiners, and how we need to, you know, be aware of them. And I try to make the argument that, you know, altcoins are basically fiat 2.0 and we need to be ignoring them and, you know, fighting against them essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a pretty comprehensive book, and it's very well structured. So people might be tempted to think it's just going to be a long diatribe of a list of issues where you're complaining. And while there is some of that, and I do love it, and I say that in a very good way, but it's also quite well structured in that you build the case in very grounded in a pretty solid foundation, where you discuss the morality of it, you discuss the implication on society and how it is used. And it is very different from the way that most people like to think of this. And, you know, even in my own work, I tend to try and just keep it quantitative and broad strokes. So, you know, I'll let the reader draw some of their own conclusions on that. But, you know, it's just, here's the supply growth rate, and then look at the implications of that. But you go way beyond that in a sense of what really is evil about this, which I think is extremely useful, because more people need to be thinking about this. It's something that is very pervasive in our life. And I keep hearing many people arrive at this realization, particularly religious people from across different religions. They take the orange pill, they understand Bitcoin, then they understand fiat money. And then they got hung up on that, on the fact that, okay, well, we know that Bitcoin fixes this, but we don't talk enough about just how evil the system is, the world in which you live in is, and how simply taking part in it is being complicit in many ways. I think it's a very difficult conversation for most people to have, because we can't give up the mental constructs and the economic constructs of what we're used to. You know, we're just used to living in this way, getting into debt, borrowing, and continuing to accumulate debt, and just not asking too many questions. Even people who come from religious traditions that tell them specifically that this should not be the way that you do it, you just kind of normalize it. You accept that, well, you know, we've got computers and the world is different now and there's economic growth and stuff, so we must do it. But I urge you to pick up this book and steel man the case for why what you are doing by participating in fiat is actually evil, and think about the implications and think about what you're going to be doing about it.
Yeah, and that's something that I think a lot of people want to ignore, because it really does, as you said, like, strike very close to home. And it's something that we've been ignoring to our moral detriment, I think. The degeneration in morality, the degeneration of a lot of things that were, like, considered completely evil just like a generation ago. It's become way more normal now. And it's kind of crazy that people think, you know, rioting in the streets or having homeless people take over your city is okay. And, you know, there are so many people that just kind of ignore reality in many ways. And this is one of the themes of the book, is that fiat lets you suspend reality in some way, shape, or form. And that's the mentality that we kind of get used to, is, okay, like, it's okay to suspend reality. And it's one of the subtle ways in which you know, sort of stray away from reality and truth. And unfortunately, that's, you know, we see that every day now, like, in all sorts of other areas, where people think it's okay to just eat sugar every day and be like 400 pounds or whatever. And they sort of act like we can suspend reality for a while. And, you know, they get on like diabetes medication and whatever. It's sort of carried over, this idea that you can create your own reality, which is essentially what fiat money is doing. And yeah, it's got serious implications, and we can see sort of like a weird derangement from a lot of people, where they've been disconnected from reality for so long that, you know, they just sort of feel like just crazy people. And you know, I think you would describe them as like uncivilized people in a way. We're like sort of going backwards in how we're treating each other, even as a result of this pervasive mentality.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, absolutely. Give us your perspective on the problems of on how fiat money affects family and relationships. I thought this was something that is that was generally not often discussed. I talk about it a little bit in the Fiat Standard, but you get into it in a lot more depth. So give our listeners that bit.
Yeah, so it used to be that we depended on our families for a lot of different things. Unfortunately, with fiat money, you have essentially the moral obligation as the money printer to solve lots of problems. And this is always sort of the argument politically that everyone gives for, you know, free healthcare, free housing, or free whatever, is that, okay, I have this problem. And because you can print money out of nothing, you have to solve it. And I mean, being sort of like reasonable, like if you want to keep the Ponzi of fiat going, you kind of have to respond to that as a government. And so they say, okay, well, we'll take care of your needs this way and that way. So at a certain point, you no longer need them, right? It becomes sort of a very alienated and sort of different relationship that we have with our families. It used to be that, you know, that was your primary identity. Instead, now it's, you know, whatever company you work for, the job that you have, or, you know, however you fit into a giant sort of fiat machine. But, you know, families used to be a lot closer and a lot more abundant and so on. Instead, we've gotten to the point where everyone is just sort of taken care of in many ways by the government or dependent on the government. And once you induce dependency, well, then, you know, all these other things are kind of extraneous. So people aren't investing in their families. People are a lot more narcissistic, thinking about their own needs. As you would say, they're very high time preference because they have this sort of like safety net that's provided for them in all sorts of ways. So, you know, fiat money essentially changes the incentives of the life that you're leading. Instead of personal responsibility and trying to create a legacy for yourself, it's just about surviving and having fun now rather than, you know, building something for later. And families, as you're very well aware, require a significant amount of long-term planning and low time preference behavior, which, you know, honestly is antithetical to the fiat mentality. So it's no surprise then that we have lowering birth rates pretty much everywhere, except for Palestine and Israel for some reason. Well, we know the reason. They're like preparing for war or something. But other than those places, everywhere else, you know, birth rates are declining because no one is thinking about leaving a legacy.
Yeah, it's actually fascinating when you think about it that the majority of people that are alive today are not going to be around. Neither they nor their descendants are going to be around in 50 years or 100 years. Most people are having very few kids, and those that are having kids, some of these kids are not having kids. So I was reading about Korea the other day. The fertility rate is under one. It's something like 0.8 or something like that.
0.78, yeah.
0.78, that's insane.
Yeah, well, it's even worse in the city of Seoul, which is where half of the population of Korea is, within like Seoul and the suburbs of it. It's 0.6, which is like, I think wow. if you calculate it, it's if you have 100 great grandparents and you leave it at 0.6, that goes to like five great grandchildren, you know, in like four generations. It's absolutely insane how few people there will be if you keep that rate up.
Yeah, it's actually quite remarkable, because the majority of the world is just not interested in the future. They don't want to turn up for the future. And I think it's kind of sad, because parenthood gives a lot of meaning to life. Mm-hmm. And in Principles of Economics, you know, in the latter chapters, you told me you were reading it. I don't want to ruin the ending for you, but I guess I will.
I haven't gotten to those chapters yet, but yeah. But I would love to hear more about it. Yeah,
yeah. I think I make the case that ultimately, why do we engage in economic activity? Why do we engage in capitalism? Why choose that over just continuing to indulge our base desires like animals, and sling our feces at each other and fight over everything, and live like animals in the jungle? What is it that's taken us out of the jungle and made us want to build a civilization? And the answer is that we have a lower time preference. Because of the lowering of our time preference, we start understanding that we could cooperate, and we can benefit a lot if we cooperate with one another rather than fight with one another. And then we understand that we can provide better lives for ourselves if we specialize and work and respect each other's property. So we develop a system of property rights, we develop a system of cooperation, trade, and then we develop money as a medium of exchange, and then we develop modern capitalist civilization as this coordination mechanism, which we can think of as really our superpower as humans. You know, when you think about animals, what they have, the lion has the claws and it has the jaws and it can do all kinds of horrible things to you because it has these kind of weapons. But what we as human beings have really is our brain. And perhaps the most sublime invention of our brain is capitalist civilization. It's what allows essentially any human being who has access to capitalist civilization to have control of a gun that can allow it to kill any animal. So it's more powerful than all the things that all animals have, because any 10-year-old girl can use a gun that can kill the most powerful animal out there, because that gun is produced through a civilization, through a capitalist economy that is drawing on the division of labor of billions of people from all over the world who cooperate to produce these things that make such sophisticated and highly productive and highly useful technologies possible for us. And so it's the lowering of time preference that allows us to get on that train of civilization and improving our life. And then the way that that manifests and the way that civilization can be sustained for longer than a few weeks is when people get into families, when people begin to view the world as being about more than just my own life and my own lifetime. Once you have children, you care about their lives as well, because, you know, they are, in a very physical sense, they are a part of you. And they're a part of you that's going to outlive you, as you understand yourself. So you're naturally very invested in their well-being. And so that lowers your time preference, because now you're not just concerned about the fun that you're going to have in your life. You're concerned about them and what's going to happen in their life. And so having a family and having children is essential, in my opinion. Well, not essential, but I would say perhaps essential, but an enormously effective factor in helping humanity lower our time preference and think more and more about the future. And therefore, become more civilized, therefore become more cooperative, become more willing and able and likely to engage in the division of labor and in economic trade. It's end of times stuff when you see people just forsaking the idea of having children and being, you know, wasting their fertile years, essentially engaged in high time preference
behavior, fascinated and focused specifically on the present, and completely ignoring the future, because it's not good, because it means that, you know, in the future we're going to be, this is going to be a world full of a lot of old people and not a lot of young people. And I think it's the first time this happens. I don't think it's ever happened in this in recorded history that we'd had a society like this.
Yeah, and you could kind of see it in one of the places that you mentioned earlier, which is Korea. You can see that it's like a society full of old people, and you see very few children. And you know, similar thing in Japan and Taiwan. It's societies full of very old people and not that many children. It's a very sort of like inverted, weird society. I want to point out something that you said earlier, that, or actually it was in your book, that I thought was extremely insightful, which is that when you have fiat money, what that does is that it makes it so that you're forced to invest, and there are companies and capital projects which get a positive nominal rate of return, but have a negative real rate of return. And you argue in the book, basically, that when you have negative real rates of return, you're actually like destroying civilization. It's literally extracting from that. And I think family formation is a bit like that. When you're like sort of pretending that you're, you know, thinking about the future, you were talking about high time preference behavior, you know, people that are, I guess, just like doing drugs and stuff like that. You know, that's obvious. But there are other sort of, you know, semi, it looks like you're kind of, you know, planning for the future. Maybe you're in grad school and like doing a postdoc for like 8 years or something like that, and sort of not having a family during that time. Like that kind of behavior is also extremely prevalent. And it's this pretending that you're actually planning for the future, but kind of like the capital that's going towards something that's got a negative real rate of return, but a positive nominal one. You know, these look like they are low time preference, but they're actually not. They're in a real sense, they are very much sort of a negative high time preference behavior. And it's covering up for the fact that you're scared of the real world and like the academic track, and it's very secure for you.
I will say that I think, you know, having I used to say this jokingly, but really not jokingly, you know, people do all kinds of stupid things in the 20s. They travel the world, or they join a band, or they you know, they try and make it as an athlete in something, and then they fail miserably. Well, in my case, I mean, I think graduate school is a little bit like that. It's it's like basically an aimless waste of your 20s for most people, I believe, because. Mm-hmm. What are you doing in a modern graduate school in terms of, think about how much time it takes? You can see how this may have made sense before the internet, when knowledge was very hard to come by. So yeah, you had to actually go to a place that had a gigantic library so that you could study all the things that pertain to whatever rabbit hole you're going to go down when researching your own subject. So you needed a large library, and you had all the experts conveniently located right next to those libraries in those universities. So it may have made sense back then. You know, you spent 5 years and then you learned things that you could not learn otherwise, and then you went back to your hometown and you were the only guy who could teach those things. But today, all of that information is available online everywhere for everyone, and you don't need to spend all of that time engaged in this credentialist circus, really, in order to learn those things. So why are you spending so much time? And for most people, the reality is, it is a credential thing. You're seeking the credential, you're seeking the degree, you're seeking the title. And that is really quite similar to what we were discussing in terms of just the highly indulgent behavior. This is how you want to waste your 20s. You know, this isn't actually helping you in a serious sense. You know, if you think about from an economic perspective, if you'd had spent that time learning a useful trade
and then started working with it. Which, you know, just to be fair, obviously some graduate students do that. Sometimes they learn useful things and then they move on with their life. But for the majority, I don't think that is really the case. So it's not an economically rational decision if you care about maximizing your economic well-being. I think the economics grad students joke that an economist is somebody who sacrifices present income in order to sacrifice future income.
So it makes zero sense whatsoever. Yet they continue, I guess, because like you're saying, they are seeking status, or they're seeking to become sort of like the chief rent seeker in some way. And, you know,
I think it's primarily status. Mm. I think it's primarily status that drives this, because whatever you wanted to do, you know, even if you wanted to rent seek, if you were out for rent seeking, there's better ways of doing it than wasting your 20s in grad school.
This is true. And there is this sort of sense that if you get to the top, then, you know, you've sort of achieved something, but it's an entire fiat game that they sort of set up sort of very artificially in the first place. Yet people go after it. It's a very strange kind of thing, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's honestly slightly degrading for somebody in their 20s to be doing it, because to a very large extent, it is jumping through hoops. You know, getting a PhD is a lot of like being a show pony. You know, you're supposed to do things the way we do them, and you're supposed to show us that you're doing things the way that we do them. And it's purely about just, you know, jumping through the hoops and then getting the degree, getting the ribbon that says, you know, first in show. you could do this. But how marketable are these skills? And, you know, I mean, some people go to grad school and they succeed and it works out well for them in the long run. And that's good. But then you got to think about the opportunity cost, which is a very important thing that is missing in fiat world. Nobody likes to think about opportunity cost. But really, the opportunity cost here is, well, if, you know, you're the kind of person who managed to make it through grad school, you're the kind of person who could have done all kinds of other things. You know, you could have learned to code probably during that time and could have worked as a coder at some startup or some major tech company. You could have probably learned a lot more marketable skills and benefit financially. This is, I think, the problem with it. But but you see this not going away. And the reason it doesn't go away, of course, as I discussed with the fiat standard, is that all of this thing is financed by fiat. These zero productivity kennel shows, basically, where you have to go jump through the hoops, they are not adding to anybody's subjective valuation of life, but they are being financed by the money printer from above. So some people can decree by fiat that this stuff needs to get money, and so it gets money. And it continues. And they go in, you know, you see them, 22-year-olds full of life, and they get into grad school. They come out broken, chewing up wrecks of human beings.
And what's worse is that even if they make it, say they get a tenure track position at a decent university, what are you doing then? You are publish or perish, and you are writing articles that don't matter. There was an interesting article that I read over the weekend that I put into my newsletter. It's like, sorry for your loss, psychology, whatever that might be. And this was in reference to the scandal that's going on in academic circles about how Dan Ariely and this other woman, like, they faked all their data. And the guy was questioning, okay, say they faked all their data and you have to retract all those studies. What knowledge do we not have now that we did before? Like, what? How does that affect psychology, the topic, in any way, shape, or form? He's like, I don't think it changes anything. And I think that's most of academic literature, and it doesn't affect anybody. It's just this game that they play of publishing that's really just sort of this weird status game that wastes a lot of time and money on a lot of things.
Yeah, although to be fair to psychologists, I mean, it's a little bit more than just status games. There's actual serious money involved, because psychologists build the building blocks for the stupid pseudoscience that is psychiatry. And that's a highly lucrative form of fiat business, where basically they've managed to pathologize human feelings and turn each one into diagnosable disease. And then you need
to buy our subscription for a lifetime supply of highly toxic, highly mind-altering, ill-studied, highly addictive, and highly profitable things because you have feelings that you don't like and that we don't like. And, oh no, yeah, you've got this feeling. Well, this is in our manual. You know, we've got a manual and it says here on page 728, if you have this feeling, we got to put you on this one particular highly profitable thing. And so, yeah, psychology has a lot of nonsense, obviously, in it. But in that world, for like the pop psychology of people who like to think of themselves as economists, like Dan Ariely or Daniel Kahneman, it's more about just getting papers published and getting research grants. And to the extent that it is in the fiat game, it might not be so much into the drugs. To be fair, it's more into the totalitarianism. So all of this, how do we nudge people to make them, to help them make better decisions for one another? But yeah, it's all stupid pseudoscience. It's all ridiculous nonsense. It means nothing. Nobody gains anything from this stuff. Maybe slightly useful for some people involved in marketing. If you run a supermarket, if you run an ad agency, maybe you'll learn a few things. But the notion that this is some kind of universal, the university applicable truths about the human condition is highly untenable nonsense. It's just another stupid fiat pseudoscience.
Yeah, and that brings up something for me that I think fiat money does. It has a tendency to focus inward, right? It's all about, it's not about like sort of expanding things outward. Pushing the frontier or creating or making something new. It's all about your own feelings, or you know, how do I make sure that I'm better? Or as you would describe it, it's very high time preference of thinking about yourself rather than thinking about, you know, your stuff, or you know, how to make your life better in the future, which is naturally outward focusing. And that is essentially what causes civilization to decline, is this narcissistic, solipsistic sort of self-focus and an inward sort of focus on, you know, what about you rather than about civilization or the future or your children or anything else that would be honestly a lot better for, you know, everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you happen to know about anything that might be able to fix all of the things that fiat ruins?
Well, the thing about fiat money is that its tentacles are absolutely everywhere. And unsurprisingly, those tentacles are in the middle of every sort of transaction that anyone makes that involves money. So if you can maybe change the money, maybe things would change a little bit in terms of incentives.
Yeah. I wonder if somebody's working on that.
I wonder if something already exists. And I mean, all joking aside, there is sort of like a very different behavior that we see out of the Bitcoin community. And I saw that you pointed this out in your book, Principles of Economics, as well. There, a lot of people are very much more low time preference and think about things very differently. You yourself, you have lots of children, and you know you're building towards something.
No, come on. I mean, you're the one who has lots of children.
You're gonna catch up. I believe you're gonna catch up.
So I'm barely beating replacement as it is.
But this idea of people that have changed incentives just because of the money that they're using, because they have a different medium of exchange, that is just absolutely fascinating to me, that it does sort of like penetrate that deeply, because you could tell who's a Bitcoiner and who's not just by how they behave, almost what kind of family they have, what they prioritize. You know, they're not, you know, doing what the typical fiat person does. And, you know, as they get deeper and deeper into Bitcoin, as they've been in Bitcoin for longer and longer, their behavior, their outlook, everything seems to be changing. And that to me is really good evidence that Bitcoin does actually fix a lot of these fiat problems.
Yeah, I think that is true. I genuinely believe that is the case. I think we hear it all the time, but it's not just that you have anecdotal evidence for it. I think it makes complete sense that it would be the case, because once you have this money that allows you to save more for the future, and that's the kind of argument that I make in really in three books, in my three books,
in the Bitcoin Standard, in the Fiat Standard, in the Principles of Economics. And each time I flog this horse from a different angle. But money is like a control knob for your time preference, because money is the most reliable way for sending value to the future. Everything else is highly risky. Every other thing other than, I mean, money of course has risks, but other things are always riskier than money because they are less liquid. And so they are much more difficult to liquidate and convert into the things that you want when you want those things. Money is our best way of saving for the future. And when that thing works well, it cannot help but fix a lot of things in us, because it focuses our orientation on the future. It makes us think about the long term, because the long term becomes possible and plausible and real, visceral. You can think about it. It starts to matter more and more to you the more you can provide for it. And the less you can provide for it, the less you think about it, the less you care for it. And therefore, the more you discount the future and the more your behavior is focused on the short term. When you study history, you read about how people behaved in the 19th century and you see how much more civilized they were in many different ways. And you see how saving rates were higher at that time. You see how you had a lot more culture of planning for the long term, stronger family structures. And you see how it is with fiat money these days. You can't help but see the relationship. It really is like a control knob for time preference.
And that's something that I think we need to really put out there, because in a sense, I think people crave some degree of being able to, I don't know, plan for the future. And, you know, this is what I would describe as virtuous behavior, the low time preference behavior or thinking about the future. People want to be more virtuous. They just don't have this tool that lets them do that. And if money really is that control knob and you get a different control knob, well, that it kind of is sort of like a hack into becoming more virtuous. So, in a sense, maybe we should be writing a new article about how getting into Bitcoin just makes you a better person. And therefore, you should get into Bitcoin, even if it's not about money, just so that you become, a better, more contributive person to society. Whereas being in something else like an altcoin or fiat will make you kind of a worse person. And anecdotally, at least, that seems to be the case.
Yeah, that definitely is the case. I think for many people, the real gains are the time preference we lost along the way. You see this in many people, like they benefit in terms of increased productivity, focus, direction in life more than they benefit from the rewards. And for a lot of people who get into Bitcoin, they get into Bitcoin with no savings because, you know, fiat people, most of them don't have any savings. So like they'll get into Bitcoin with a very small amount and you don't have a lot of savings. And also you don't really trust it. You don't understand it very well. You get it, but you're not sure how to store it. You don't really trust the exchange. You don't know if you're going to mess up your wallet or whatever. So for most people, it starts off with a small sum of money. But then the fact that you see this thing and you're thinking about the implications of it, you start really benefiting. I'd say this was the case for me because, you know, initially when I first heard and started getting into Bitcoin, I still didn't understand it very well enough to trust it enormously and to put like significant sums of money into it. But the changes that it did, just because I could imagine that, you know, this thing might actually work and then we'd have a functioning civilization again, made me get my act together and get married and start a family. And
write three books.
And write three books. Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think it had a huge impact on changing me as a human being, far more beneficial than the number go up and the price rises. But of course, the number go up is the bait that you have to take in order to get drawn into this.
Yeah. So thinking about it from an individual perspective, the thing for me that I think changes for a lot of people is that your sacrifice is actually rewarded in Bitcoin. Whereas in a fiat money standard, oftentimes you sacrifice something, right? You forego some good. But then like you see your friend that didn't sacrifice and they get bailed out or they end up being able to take on more debt to like kind of get out of that. You're not really rewarded for
such. And the debt that they took on gets devalued. So it turns out to have been actually a wise choice to get into irresponsible debt, because the irresponsible debt is money that gets devalued.
Right.
And so you end up getting a bargain on it because you bought it irresponsibly.
and you know, so there's no like sort of feedback mechanism which rewards low time preference behavior, because making a sacrifice now is essentially the crux of low time preference behavior is that you sacrifice now so you can have something later. But under a fiat standard, what you get is you sacrifice now and it doesn't matter. So of course you have less motivation, less incentive to make sacrifices now. And that's something that I think a lot of people kind of realize, is that you can kind of live paycheck to paycheck and not worry about tomorrow, and things will be kind of okay. And you know, you're not like sort of improving, but you can, you know, you're ossified in whatever sort of lifestyle you're in. And that's, you know, it's stagnation, I guess, but people are okay with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, but it's truly, I really truly think it is life-changing for people how Bitcoin affects them. And I think it's absolutely a blessing that we are born in this time where we saw this, we saw fiat world get to its absolute nadir, I would say. I mean, who knows? I'm sure they have still a lot more left for us. I think we're going to plumb new depths. Just on momentum alone, you know, even if things do get worse, there's so much more potential energy in this train wreck that's derailing off of a 10,000 foot cliff. So I don't know if we've hit rock bottom yet, because it could still be a while. But I think we have at least seen the beginning of the turn upward, in a sense of, you can see how technology, first of all, is increasing productivity. So even without Bitcoin, I think the saving grace here is that the internet has managed to take off in terms of its productivity because it wasn't stifled by economic regulation like pretty much everything in the physical world. It has taken off and it has made the physical world so much better for all of us. It's increased our productivity enormously. Everybody, even if you don't work online, you benefit from the fact that the people who manufacture your stuff are using the internet and are using machines and computers and all of these wonderful additions to our productivity. But as I say, in the principles of economics, I mean, the reason you want to be optimistic about the state of the world is that technology continues to find a way. We always come across problems, and we, because we have that superpower that I was mentioning earlier as a capitalist civilization, we have the ability to cooperate and collaborate and to divide labor amongst ourselves and to innovate and to trade and to use money as a coordination mechanism for our society. Because we're able to do all of that, we can muster much more power and brain power at any problem than the problem itself can. And that applies to wild lions or bears attacking our cities. It applies to natural disasters, and it applies to human-made disasters like fiat money, which is destroying human civilization, I would say. But I think with Bitcoin, we can turn this around.
Yeah, and you can kind of feel it. It like clown world, fiat world, it seems to be collapsing. In so many ways, all of that high time preference behavior is sort of accumulating on itself. And we're seeing sort of breakdowns in a lot of places. You've spoken a lot about Lebanon and sort of the weird sort of bottom that you hit there. And when I was there, what I was really surprised by was how much it's bounced back from the bottom because of, I guess, the excesses of the government and how much the free market sort of took on to mitigate for the fact that the government just isn't doing its job, like providing electricity or something like that. So I have a lot of hope because of people being able to, you know, cope with the fact that the government isn't doing these things. And I think as fiat collapses, we have a lot of technological improvements and things like that, which will help to sort of give us a softer landing than you would in a typical hyperinflation scenario.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I definitely think so. All right. So what else do you want to tell us about the book?
Why should people read it?
I get into a lot of this stuff, and we've discussed a lot of it. But one thing I think I wanted to point out in particular were the two chapters that are probably most controversial, the one on art. I think you would quite appreciate. And then the other one is on science and how the model of science that we have right now is actually far more socialist and far less like free market. It's unfortunately held down by lots and lots of gatekeepers at every turn. Like you were saying, to get a PhD, you have to jump through a lot of hoops. And to get a tenure track position, that's even more hoops. And essentially, it's, all of those people are gatekeepers. And you're not really getting real science anymore. It's basically kind of like the Soviet era, kind of, like, let's just add funding to it and see what happens. And, they couldn't build the things that they wanted to, no matter how much money they threw at it. And it's just sort of like this weird model where they think money will solve everything and it doesn't. Similar thing with art, where people value things because the elites tell them that to value it. And it's unfortunately meant that you get way less good art. And I was reflecting on this earlier. The reason we don't have patrons anymore, right? People that will, the Medicis, for example, were famous patrons, and a lot of people during that era where you had really brilliant artists that were paid basically by these patrons to produce art. Well, you don't have that anymore because no one knows what good art is. It used to be that somebody had, the patron had to have like a sense of what good art was and saw the talent in somebody and decided to fund them. That's no longer a model because art is determined kind of top down by some authority, by museum curators, by art critics or something like that, instead of, being obvious, which I think was the case for a very long time.
Yeah. And I think a big part of the corruption of art comes from the fact that people need to use art as a store of value because the money sucks. And so there's all this extra demand that's being added there just because of the fact that once an artist makes it to the point where their name is recognized, eventually they're going to die and they're not going to be making any more. So the demand is likely to continue to grow, but the supply is going to never grow after a certain point. And so therefore this makes it a shitcoin, basically. It's individually, perhaps it's not a shitcoin because eventually the artist stops making them, but it is a shitcoin in that you can make more artists and they just keep making them. And because there's a monetary incentive on making more artists, it gets easier and easier to make more artists. There's no difficulty adjustment that ensures that because we have more artists competing to make art, only the best get to make art. Everybody gets to make it because everybody else is looking for something to park their money in rather than the money. So people start valuing this. And then because you value it, I value it because I can sell it to you and then you can sell it to somebody else. And now we have all this extra demand for all of these works of art that any loser comes along and puts two brush strokes on a canvas. And, they're basically serving monetary demand. They're meeting monetary demand. People want this. And so the degradation in quality is that as long as you beat fiat money, you're going to find a lot of demand for anything. As long as the value, as long as the market price is likely to outperform fiat money over the long term, which is a very low bar, very easy to clear.
Well, it is now, yeah.
Yeah, it keeps getting easier and easier with time. Then that buying that thing beats holding on to the money. And so when we don't have that safe money that we can just hold on to and know that it can appreciate and know that it has good value, when it's not burning a hole in our pocket at all times, when we're not constantly looking for a place to use it, then we can be discerning. Then you don't need to find whatever piece of art that you can buy. Then you can just hold on to money. And it makes a huge difference because then with businesses, you will only invest in businesses that offer a real positive return. And with art, you're only going to buy art that you truly believe is going to outperform in its subjective valuation to you, is going to outperform the money that you have and the market's appreciation of the money because of the money's scarcity. So that's going to have to be something special. Mm-hmm. That's why
we had the Sistine Chapel on gold standard.
Yeah.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, the quality of everything goes up when you take out the monetary function of it. In a sense,
exactly.
What you were saying is that you have this monetary function as a store of value that people are using it for. But if you, there's an excess demand that wouldn't be there otherwise because of that. But if you remove that demand, then people just have to produce better things. And that's not just true in art, of course. That's true in even normal consumer goods. I reflected on this when I was traveling is the way I evaluate purchases had a significant amount of input from how much I could sell it for later, right? So you buy cars with a high resale value because in a sense, you're using it subtly as a store of value because the money's so bad and you don't want to lose a lot of money. Then it came to me that under something like a Bitcoin standard, then, you know, which I'm basically on, I don't think that way anymore. It's about the utility of the thing and less about the store of value function. It's not about resale value. And unfortunately, I think most people think in those terms of, okay, like everything kind of has some monetary function rather than the utility function. And you don't get like as good utility out of these things because you're thinking so much about the monetary aspect.
Absolutely. Indeed. All right. Let's see if anybody here has any questions from the audience, any of the attendees. Anybody here has anything to ask Jimmy?
I didn't realize there were people listening. I see in the chat that there's a whole bunch of people. Yeah.
Yeah. Monica's saying she's an artist and it's 100% a shitcoin market. The art world is rotten.
Yeah.
It is. You know, one thing I find pretty fascinating about this whole Bitcoiners going after artists thing is that, you know, modern artists have made their name, obviously not through any kind of artistic accomplishment. You know, nobody's made a Sistine Chapel anytime recently. Mm-hmm. And nobody's done anything kind of spectacular in the sense of the amount of hard work. Well, maybe nobody is an exaggeration. I'm sure there are some great artists out there. But the famous artists of the day, the people that are viewed as the superstars of the art world, they have mainly made their name through shock and awe, basically, rather than talent and hard work. And so, you know, you could spend, and I mentioned this in the Bitcoin standard, like Michelangelo, he wrote a poem about the 4 years he spent hanging from the roof of the Sistine Chapel in order to paint it. And the heavy toll that it took on him. And so that's one way that you could make a name for yourself. But of course, there is another way, which is you could take a statue of the Virgin Mary and put it in a jar and piss on it and then put it in an exhibition. Mm-hmm. And then people will applaud you for being brave and for having vision and for being such a great artist. And a huge amount of modern art is just about that. It's talentless hacks who just choose to shock and offend as opposed to trying to produce anything of value. And then they use the reaction to them as justification, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm being repressed and society rejects this. Well, you know, maybe do something that's not so stupid. But in any case, this is presented as if it is some kind of great artistic accomplishment. And then I write about it in the Bitcoin standard and I call these people idiots effectively. And then all of those people get shocked and get offended worse than the religious people that they're trying to mock. And it's just such an amazing, amazing reversal of roles because the artists like to present themselves as if they're challenging the taboos of society. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they do something sacrilegious, it's brave. All right. So what happens if I call Damien Hirst an idiot? People get really angry. Apparently, it's considered sacrilegious. Like, no, you just don't understand art. You don't understand art. And like, how could you? How could you write that? How could you say that? Well, how could they put the jar of piss? That's okay. You know, that's brave art. But so they can insult all the sacred cows of society, but then they become the sacred cow of society. You can't insult them.
It's true. I had to put a trigger warning before the art chapter because so many people, more people get offended from that art chapter than any other chapter. And I just said, hey, if you're into modern art, you might want to skip this chapter. Although, you know, like, because you're probably not going to like me afterwards. And this is the thing. There is sort of like a religious element to art that is very fiat imposed, right? Like, oh, Picasso is amazing. Of course he is, right? Like that's sort of like the conventional wisdom. And to question that is to be a heretic. It's just like they want to crucify you for saying that. How could you say that Picasso's not amazing? Because it looks gross and disgusting, but that's not what, you know, he was trying to do that. And that's the reaction. It's like, you sure it wasn't because, you know, it's much easier to paint those and you could produce 50 of those a day. And, you know, he can sell each of them for a lot of money. Like, you know, there's so much of this fiat sort of, you know, top down opinion making where they keep you in line, on a narrow range of opinions you're allowed to have that pervade the art world, as it does every other world. You know, it's kind of refreshing to be able to break out of that as a Bitcoiner, honestly, because it is kind of stifling to all kinds of creativity and all kinds of productivity that we could have, if we weren't constrained by them, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Dorian has a question. Go ahead, Dorian.
Okay, yeah. So, Jimmy, I finished reading your book, Thank God for Bitcoin, I think around 2 weeks ago. It's a really great book with a lot of, you know, insights. So, and I agree with the, you know, one of the theses that, you know, Bitcoin really shows you way back to the low time preference, as it did with me, I think like around three, four years ago. You know, when I started going to Bitcoin, after 10 years of, you know, militant atheism, I returned to, you know, to my religion of, you know, Christian Catholicism. And so I really, really like the book and I recommend it to people. And, but, you know, for my experience, you know, life experience and, you know, living in Europe and seeing how it is developing, my mind is like the real question, you know, connecting money and religion. And with John Keynes, you know, saying, you know, in the long run, we are all dead, you know, so there is no future. Question is atheism hard fiat?
That's a great question. I would argue that fiat money is an atheist money. It presumes no higher order, right? It is whoever is in charge gets to determine everything. So it's kind of naturally atheist in that regard. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that it's the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto, right? That's complete state control of money. I would say that, you know, atheism as it currently is a very kind of unique phenomenon, and it's not historically prevalent at all. If you think from a philosophical perspective, you know, you either have to have the ultimate cause or there's nothing, right? Like, and there's no, very few philosophers went out and said there's no ultimate cause or something like that. Nobody really made that claim until more recently. The way that atheists have sort of made their argument in the last, I don't know, 60, 70 years is very fiat in the sense that they are kind of clever, but they purposefully ignore the, you know, hundreds of years of tradition of the proofs of different proofs of God. I mean, like Plato made one, Aristotle made one, and they're all different arguments, right? About ultimate cause. And they're kind of subtle from a philosophical, metaphysical angle, but they've been there the entire time. Instead, you know, the typical atheist tactic is to drop a bunch of straw men and knock those down. That this has been Sam Harris's calling card and for a long time. So I would say it's got fiat characteristics, and unfortunately that plays well in a fiat under a fiat money. But maybe that changes under Bitcoin. What do you think, Sig?
I think I'm inclined to agree with you. I think there is, I continue to be surprised at just how religious Bitcoin folk are. Because you would expect, you know, initially you would expect this as a futuristic tech
it'd be much more appealing to the kind of, you generally have this association, the more into technology you are, the more you would generally be progressive politically, and therefore more of a kind of worldview where everything, you know, we have so much more technological power now, we can do all kinds of things. That, I think, generally you would expect that would go more with an atheistic worldview. And yet, with Bitcoin, you find the exact opposite. And it is quite noticeable, and I think it's quite confusing for many people, that they don't expect this kind of people writing books called Thank God for Bitcoin. And you see Christians, Muslims, Jews, people from all kinds of walks of life, from religious people, seeing very religious themes in Bitcoin. And, you know, it's just this piece of software that's just out there making a new block every 10 minutes. And people are having religious experiences. It's quite telling. I think there's something about it. And I think the case that I also make in Principles of Economics is a little bit, perhaps I don't quite phrase it that way, but I should have maybe phrased it this way, is that we can understand civilization as being made up of the things that are conducive to civilization. And if we understand civilization as being about long-term thinking and low time preference, then the kind of institutions that would foster that kind of approach would be conducive for having successful societies and successful civilizations that improve quality of life over time. And so family is one of these because it makes you have a low time preference. And I think religion is another one. And in fact, if you think about religious edicts in terms of their impact on time preference, pretty much all of them are effectively telling you to lower your time preference. You know, don't just think about what is, don't give in to the temptation of the minute. Don't give in to the base desires. Don't give in to do the things that you want to do right now because of anger, because of lust, because of gluttony, because of all of these failures and sins and weaknesses. And instead, think about the long term, think about the afterlife, which effectively is a way of lowering your time preference all the way down to zero. I mean, that's essentially what religion is doing, is telling you that you're going to be living forever after death. And therefore, you need to weigh that very heavily as opposed to the temptations of today. And that helps. I mean, if I were to try and explain it in an economic terms, why you would see this, you would see these kind of worldviews around Bitcoin go toward that. I would say that this is the common factor, that it's the evolutionary advantage, in a sense, of religion, is that it fosters low time preference behavior. And that's what gets a lot of religious people interested in Bitcoin. And that's what I think also makes a lot of Bitcoin people become more and more interested in religion. Dorian is not the only one. I've heard this from many people as well.
Yeah, I've gotten that comment from so many people. Every conference I go to, I get at least one or two people saying, you know what, I haven't been going to church for many years, but after I read the book, I, you know, started going. And it speaks to sort of the, you know, different incentives at play because these people are in Bitcoin, including yourself. So, so thank you for that.
Yeah, we are going to outbreed the secularist.
I think so.
Yeah, I think this is the flip side of the fertility. I mean, that 0.78 fertility you mentioned in Korea. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's 0.78 as an average, but there's a lot of zeros there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for every zero, there's a 1.4. For every two zeros, there's a 2.1 fertility. And then for every three zeros, there's a 2.8. And for every four zeros, there's somebody out there who's got, you know, five and more kids. And these tend to be the people that are conservative and tend to be the people that are religious. So we may have depopulation for a while. We may have, in many of these countries, the population is going to go down, but I think it's going to bounce back because the high fertility people are going to then dominate just naturally. There's going to have to come a point at which the bleeding out of the high fertility into low fertility is reversed, just because the rewards for fertility are going to continue to go up because, you know, your kids just need to turn up in order to win the future.
pretty much. Yeah. I'm always encouraged by the number of Bitcoin babies that I see. And, you know, at least in the past couple of years, I've seen so many. And yeah, I think in that way, it's sort of like a self-healing mechanism. Whenever things get too fiat, you know, nobody has kids, but that means only the really low time preference people are having lots of kids. And those are the ones that will end up building civilization. We just have to make sure that they're not under a fiat influence as we go forward.
Well, now they can opt out because we have Bitcoin. Yeah. That's the good thing about it. All right. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for writing the book. And I look forward to having the physical copy in my hands. I still don't have it yet, but I look forward to getting it and getting the signed copy. And you've started a crowdfunding campaign. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, it's fiatruinseverything.com, and you can buy all sorts of signed things on there, or maybe even have me come to your meetup if you want. That's one of the items on there. But yeah, you can order it on there. I'm using Zaprite. You can pay Lightning, Bitcoin, or credit card, and it makes it like super easy. So been pretty impressed with that. But yeah, the crowdfund ends on September 6th. So if you're interested, please go and support my work.
And when will the physical copies start shipping?
I've already started shipping the paperbacks. The hardcover will be coming in the next few weeks. The audiobook, I still have to produce. The ebook should be ready fairly soon. But yeah, those are the main ones. The other ones are specific to the person, and I'll be contacting you if you want those.
Cool. All right. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for writing this book, and best of luck on everything.
Oh, thank you, Saif. You've been a major inspiration for a lot of my work. So pleasure to be on your podcast talking about it.
Thank you, sir. Take care.